D&D Versus is a spooky, scary, vile, and violent podcast intended for mature listeners. Content warnings can be found in the episode description.
All right, welcome to D&D Versus, an actual play D&D adventure, where one dungeon master focuses all of his malevolent creative energy on a single player. My name is Yanato Ballou. I will be your dungeon master for this adventure, and I am joined by JT Embley. JT, if you could introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about the character that you'll be playing from this adventure.
Hello, I'm JT. My character for this adventure is named Stephen Hark. He is a elf ranger. He has not been adventuring long, and he has had fallings out with several parties at this point due to his brusque nature. At this point, he was abandoned and left for dead by his previous party because he failed to make any lasting impression on them. And he died rather ignominiously, falling into a pit trap in a dungeon.
Well, even though you died and you are fully aware of being dead, suddenly your eyes open, and that's where we'll start the adventure. You are in a dark, enclosed space, but because you're an elf, I believe you have dark vision. Is that correct?
Yes, I have dark vision 60.
Okay, great. So give me a perception roll without disadvantage, since you have dark vision, and I'll tell you what you perceive first.
That is a 10.
All right, so with a 10, it's a very enclosed space. You can tell that you're in like a tight box. You barely have enough room to like even put your elbows out. Like you can't even lift your elbows in like a chicken wing style. But you can tell as you try to flex and figure out the space that you're lying prone on your back. Your arms are kind of crossed over your chest. In one hand, you can feel what seems to be like a sheaf or bundle of papers. And in the crook of your other arm, you can feel sort of this cold glass jar. You can also feel something on your face. And then finally, for hearing, you can kind of make out muffled noises that seem to be coming from above you. It sounds like people talking as if you're hearing them through a very thick wall.
Do I get the sense that I'm in a coffin, that I've been buried?
I would say that's a reasonable assumption, yeah.
Okay. I'm going to begin shouting at the top of my lungs, "Hey! Hey! Anybody! Hey!" and start banging my arms and legs against the top of the coffin, trying to make as much noise as I possibly can.
Okay.
Without damaging the glass object in my hand, because I don't really want glass shards hanging out in this coffin with me.
Yeah, totally fine. So there's a momentary pause in the noises that you were hearing on the other side. So the noises on the other side of the coffin were this kind of like scooping noise. I mean, I would say that it's pretty reasonable to assume that it sounds like somebody was either in the process of burying you or digging you out. And whatever voices you were hearing in addition to that sort of working noise, stop abruptly.
I'm not dead! Help! Help!
Okay, give me another perception roll between your shouts.
16.
Okay, so with a 16, you hear quick, panicked exchange of words, and you can make out this sort of deep voice that, with a 16, you can tell is filled with a certain amount of dread.
He's supposed to be dead. He's supposed to be dead. We gotta go before Pringle comes.
And then you just hear a couple of footsteps because they're not that far away. But whoever was digging you out or burying you is gone. With a 16, you can also tell that the string or rope that's dangling on your face is somehow going through a hole in the coffin directly over your face and seems to go out into the dirt above. What would you like to do?
I would like to pull on the rope.
Okay. So taken from actual morbid history, I don't know if any of our listeners are familiar with this, but some people in olden times used to be buried with a string attached to a bell over their gravestone just in case they were buried alive. So you are pulling on such a string and you hear the jangling and dinging noise of a bell ringing with your tugs. It's a few minutes, but eventually you hear that sort of digging noise resuming. And a new voice is sort of grumbling, saying,
"They don't check them right, they just dump them in, because it's more convenient for old Pringle to deal with it, old Pringle."
And then you hear the scraping of metal on wood as this Kringle person who's grumbling up above you hits the coffin. Within a minute, there's a rush of cool air. There's light around you as the coffin is opened up. And there's a stooped old man with a humanoid body, very, very gangly, long limbs. He's stooped over by old age. And his body and everything below the neck looks human. But stitched to his neck is a pig's head that is now looking at you with a certain amount of consternation and confusion.
Oh, hi.
Hello.
And he kind of squints at you and says,
were you always an elf when we buried you?
I think so. Where did you find me?
Well, you were just dropped here by the church. Church dropped off bodies, Pringle buries them.
Oh. Are you very good at that?
And he says, yes, not quite as good at digging them up, but come on out with you then.
And he hoists himself out of the hole that had been dug to unearth your coffin. And he kind of lays down flat on his stomach so he can extend his arm with proper ballast to help you out of the grave. As you emerge, you find that I don't know how many people can tell the difference between sunrise and sunset on site, but you can tell that the sun is just below the horizon in whatever direction you're looking, and that you seem to be standing on some kind of an island because you can very clearly see the ocean all around you. This island is unusual in that it is these sort of four plateaus. You can see a lower plateau where there's a village and what looks like a pier extending out from it. You can also see another plateau sort of a little bit lower than the one you happen to be on. So I'm going from lowest up to highest. So the second plateau has a large church with a small sort of estate behind it. Nothing too grandiose, but a couple houses and some other sort of structures that look like stables. And then spinning around and getting the full perspective, you see that the highest mesa is surrounded by this sort of wall constructed out of hewn logs that are about 20 feet tall. And you can see that there is sort of this rising mountain up behind it. You can make out thatched rooftops of various structures, and you can even see what look to be like mining equipment sort of peeking up over the log wall that I've described. But the third tier, the third mesa or plateau that you're on, is all gravestones. And there's a small shack and a wrought iron fence sort of surrounding everything. Pringle is kind of looking at you with just one eyebrow cocked. Surprisingly, he doesn't look super put out, but he does notice the items that you're holding in your arms and kind of raises an eyebrow at the sheaf of papers. And he points at it and says,
looks like you were buried with church papers. So like I said, church gave me your body. I buried you.
Yeah. Thanks for that, Mr. Pringle. So do I have my items on me from my character sheet?
Yep. So you have your full inventory of starting items, but you also have the two items that I've described. You have the jar that now that you're out in the open, you have the jar that's filled with this sort of like black inky liquid. And what Pringle is mostly focused on right now is the sort of bundle of papers that you now notice has a wax seal on it. With a strange symbol or insignia sort of pressed into the wax, it looks to be the face of a woman with her eyes covered, with five beams of light emanating from her head.
Interesting. I'll kind of hold up the papers to Mr. Pringle, yes?
Oh, yeah, maybe this might offer some clarity. Might want to go see Father Tully if it's confusing for me. But
so he kind of uses a finger to break the wax as neatly as possible because he wants to help preserve the seal for you just in case it might help. I'm going to roll dex for him to see if he manages to do that. Yeah. So he manages to just perfectly pry it up. So the seal is in perfect state. And he opens it up and sort of folded in. There are two sets of papers in here. The outer paper is fairly large. It's like, 12 by 18. And it has very beautiful calligraphy in a sort of lightly purple, just off black, like midnight purple ink. And it reads the following. This declaration by purview of the Crimson Elders of the Church of Honda Days grants free passage across open borders to And then Pringle kind of squints and he continues, with assurances and protections of the church herein, signed Elder Toyota Thon. He holds the paper out to you and says,
This is where your name should go. What's your name?
So he points at a blank spot that he kind of paused at in the paper.
Stephen.
He says, well, it doesn't say Stephen. It says nothing. And then he pulls out a smaller piece of paper on just smaller parchment. And he kind of squints reading this one because the writing is much smaller. And he just kind of scoffs and says, you some kind of poet. And he holds out the small paper to you, which reads, if your eyes read this, then they are eyes that see our triumph over death. They are eyes that will see the throne of our rebellion against the dark Mother Death. Come east to the rising sun. I wait with the rite of your rebirth at the heart of Vishnu's founding capital. Signed, the marvelous Professor Frankenfooter.
Have I heard any of these names before I died?
No, I would say that without even making you roll for anything, this island is a complete mystery to you. You've never heard of an island of such unique geography. And I would say that as you begin taking more and more in, you realize that this island isn't set at sea level. You're actually high above the ocean. Somehow this island is just this towering mesa that has risen up out of the sea with just these four plateaus on it. You don't recognize any of these names. You don't recognize the names of these churches. It is a completely foreign situation to you.
Well, Mr. Pringle, thank you for saving me from suffocating to death. I believe I'll be traveling east now, since that's what the note says.
And he says, well, and he kind of puts his hands over the butt of his shovel and kind of rests his chin on it in a sort of thoughtful way. He says,
well, those papers will help you get off the island, but not without a name on them. And I think you need someone real official-like to put your name on it. You can't just go scratching it in or else it won't pass check. Might want to stop by Father Tully.
And he kind of cocks his head towards the church and estate that I mentioned, the next mesa below you.
He says, or just see somebody who's, you know, more official-like and has the church's official ink.
Thank you. That's a good suggestion. Some people tell me I'm a little bit rude, so I apologize if this is a bit rude. Why are you a pig?
And he doesn't look offended by it. He just kind of shrugs and says,
to be honest, I'm surprised you don't have some kind of animal head. Oh, just since you seem a little bit discombobulated, I'll help you out here. This island is a holding camp for people that have been victims of the... You have a letter from Professor Frankenfooter, right? His dad and his old man is a doctor, as opposed to a professor, and a good doctor... were his experiments, and the church couldn't undo the experimentations, but was able to give us a life away from, say, the persecutions that we might be victim to. So most of the people on this island are such as me.
So you were a man, but now you are still a man with a pig's head.
Yeah, kind of pointless, isn't it? The thing is, I don't have any memories of before having this head, so I was born as you see me, fully formed in a weird way.
I suppose I'll go see the good father then.
He says, right, on with you.
And so as you proceed, there are sloping paths that connect these various plateaus. So it's pretty easy to make out a way towards the church estate. You also make out that the sun is coming up finally, so you have a good sense of which way is east. And you are currently headed east towards the church estate. The mining operation at the uppermost plateau is on the south end of the island as you begin to figure out which way is which. And the port and pier and village that I mentioned is at the northernmost tip of the island. As you travel across the way and as the sun is coming up, you begin to make sense of how there is a pier on an island that seems to be over 100 feet above the ocean. You realize that the pier isn't so much a pier as it is sort of a loading bay that has a complex set of machinery and pulley systems that are actually lifting boats and barges out of the ocean below and bringing them up to plateau level. You can see even that there are three ships waiting off the coast for various reasons, but just on site, you can tell that they might be a little bit too large for the pulley and lifting system, but you can continue to the church if you would like, or you can go anywhere you want on the island.
I will continue toward the church.
Okay. So you arrive at the church, and it's more of a small chapel. It has a steeple, and there's sort of this bust or gargoyle of a woman, very similar to what you have on the wax seal. That is the passport papers. This woman is, from the waist up, just very lovely, wearing this flowing gown that's expertly carved into the stone of the church. And she's holding her hands up as if she's holding the rays of light that are emanating from her head. And she's holding the two of them that are on either side of the crown of her skull, and then there are three more, one at the top and then symmetrically. And there are these large wooden doors, and you can hear just casual conversation happening on the other side of the doors between a man and a woman. What would you like to do?
I will knock on the doors.
All right, so the conversation stops. You hear just some light shuffling, and one of the doors opens, not tentatively or, you know, tremorously or anything like that, just, you know, only partway, as a very portly man, this one with a cow's head, greets you.
Oh, what's this?
Hello, my name is Stephen Hark. Mr. Pringle at the cemetery told me to come see the good father here for my papers to be signed.
He looks pleasantly confused by this. He says,
oh, must be quite a theological conundrum if you're visiting the grave before you visit the church, but come in, come in, come in.
And he sort of gestures you in, and you see that it's a chapel. Up in the front pew, you can see a young woman with a fox's head, wearing a sort of white habit, so it looks like religious garb. As she turns around in the front pew to watch you and the father, who introduces himself as, I'm Father Tully, so please tell me about your concern. Let's see what the good sister and I can do for you.
Well, Father Tully, I remember dying. I woke up in a coffin. Some gentlemen seemed to be burying me. When I called out for help, they said something about Pringle coming, and they seemed concerned. Then Mr. Pringle came and dug me out, and I had in my hands this strange jar and these papers. And these papers tell me to go east and give me leave to pass through borders and such, but they don't have my name on them.
And he says, well, would you mind if I take a look at these items? Maybe I can help sort out for you.
Sure. And I will hand over my papers.
Okay. So just the papers, you're holding onto the jar?
For now, yeah. I'll just hand him one thing at a time.
Okay, so he walks up to the dais and uses the lectern to sort of spread your papers out and puts on a pair of spectacles over his cow eyes, which you realize had to be very, very thoroughly adjusted to fit onto a cow's head. But these very wide-brimmed spectacles sit on his face as he squints down at the papers. So first he reads the passport and says,
Elder Toyota Thon. He's.
And he just keeps going, And then he switches over to the smaller paper with the note from the marvelous Professor Frankenfurt. He goes,
Jimmy, are you a consort or a companion or an accomplice of this Professor Frankenfurter?
I have never met or heard of him before.
Well, then, but he's a wanted man.
Oh.
Professor Frankenfurter, he's a criminal. He's a traitor of the church. The only people that may want his head on a pike more than our church, our temple, is the Order Infernus. It's a wonder that he has gotten away. How you are sure you have no idea how you came by this note or what is your involvement with him?
Like I said, I died and I woke up and now I'm here.
Give me a persuasion roll.
Okay. Right. 9.
You just see him like furrow his brow and give a nod over your shoulder. And the next thing you know, you hear running footsteps as the sister runs towards the door of the chapel and bars it. And she kind of presses her back against it. And while you turn around to look at that, Father Tully just takes a few steps towards a rope at the back of the chapel and just gives it a hard tug, and a bell starts to ring.
Hey, whoa. I don't know this man.
He says, I understand, but this, you have communications. You arrived on our island with papers that grant you passage, but don't grant you passage, asking if I can fix them to grant you passage, and you bear correspondence with a wanted criminal. All we are doing is notifying the Order Infernus so that the local captain can come and ask you questions and ascertain what help you might be able to provide in tracking down this criminal.
Right. Can I sit down and wait?
Absolutely. It would be preferred, and it's a credit to your compliance. So he nods at Sister Tully and says, can we get you something to drink in the meantime? The captain is coming down from the piers.
Water would be nice.
Sister Tully curtsies and disappears into a sort of back room behind the dais, while Father Tully just kind of crosses his arms, but he leans against the altar at the front of the chapel and just kind of eyes you, like, not necessarily with any kind of animosity or anything like that, but he's clearly trying to figure you out. So he looks and says, I'm sure Captain Ludlow will have questions of his own, but this is a, you understand how this looks to me. A man comes into my chapel, says that he was dug out of a grave, has papers signed by the highest member of my church, and a letter from the most wanted criminal. You see how those two things, well, I shouldn't say that you're in any trouble, but I would be remiss if I didn't follow up more thoroughly and especially cover to make sure that the Order Infernus has their say as well.
Well, Mr. Pringle can attest to my story, or part of it at least.
Right. Well, tell Captain Ludlow to check on that. Mr. Pringle is well-trusted and well-regarded, but he's an old man, and I don't want to trouble him to come to our mesa unless he absolutely must.
Within a few seconds of that, there is a knock at the door to the chapel as Sister Tully comes out with your water. She also brought some fruits and snacks and offers them to you while Father Tully goes and unbars the door to the chapel. A tall man, looking to be just over 6 feet, but not with an animal head. He has this sort of sallow face, and he looks very depressed, if I'm being honest. He's got dark hair, says,
Yes, Father Tully, is there something wrong? Did those kids pull something up here? And Father Tully says, no, it's far more interesting than that. I think you'll find that the trip you made up is quite worth it. Come.
And he ushers in Captain Ludlow. And you can see Captain Ludlow is wearing fairly nice armor. Looks a little bit worn in. Clearly he's seen battle, but he moves with this kind of lazy sort of discontentedness of somebody who feels like their time is being wasted, if that makes sense. And he looks at you and says,
yes, how do you do? My name is Captain Ludlow. I'm the head of operations for the Order Infernus on the Rock. And he holds out a hand for you.
I will stand and shake his hands and say, hello, how do you do? I am Stephen Hark.
Stephen Hark. And he thinks about it and he says, I don't have that name anywhere on my logs of visitors or current citizens of the Rock. How did you arrive recently?
Well, I was dead at the time.
You were dead?
Yes. I was killed. I fell in a pit and was left there. It was not a pleasant experience to starve to death. But I'm here now. I was buried by some gentlemen, and Mr. Pringle came and saved me from being buried. Those bells are very useful, by the way.
And Father Tully nods and says, yes, sometimes we have misappropriations of bodies that sometimes all they need is a good kit, and then they're back up. So it's a safety precaution. Glad it came into handy with you. It seems as if, however, that our corpse was buried with, or somehow through whatever process of resurrection took place, came back into being with some rather official papers.
And he points at the passport parchment. Captain Ludlow just politely asks, may I take a look?
Of course.
All right, so he takes the papers from you, and first he reads over the passport. Okay, well, I mean, it's my opinion that you were buried with this, so it belongs to you. And he kind of looks at Father Tully as if it's, you know, seems like a pretty cut and dry issue. He says, but this is curious. And he reads over the letter that's signed by the marvelous Professor Frankenfooter. And he says, how were you... And he just can't quite seem to place what the question he wants to ask is. And he says, what do you know about this professor?
I have never met him before. I've never heard of him before. And everyone seems to think that I should know who he is, but I have frankly no idea.
You see some gears turning in his head. He's holding on to the parchment. He looks at Father Tully and he says, Father Tully, can I speak with this person one-on-one for just a moment? And Father Tully just immediately agrees and says, yes, absolutely. Please. Order Infernus takes precedent on this island. And he sort of walks through the back room where the sister went and got you the snacks. The sister kind of squints at Captain Ludlow and just says in a very low voice, you have an angle here. And she looks at you, Stephen, and she says, don't agree to anything because it seems like you're still figuring out your footing here. I'll let you talk to him alone, but if you want to hear a second opinion, we're just in the back room, okay?
I will not.
So she follows Father Tully into the back, and Captain Ludlow is rubbing his cheek that has a little bit of 5 o'clock shadow. It looks like he's been pulling a night shift. Listen, whether or not you know Professor Frankenfooter, and let's hold on that if for now. You have a letter signed by him, so clearly you matter to him. He's a wanted criminal that lied, chiseled, and stole magical artifacts. He embezzled from both the Church of Honda Days as well as the Crimson Elders. He promised to build a machine for both orders at the same time, took advantage of both, and then hightailed it out with his riches. We need to track him down, and I'm not going to lie, it would be a pretty big get for the Order Infernus if we can get him. So what I would like to do is I can help you get off this island. If I ask it, Father Tully will pull out the Order of Honda Day's special ink that is needed to validate these papers for you. And we can set sail and we can track down this professor. However, don't let me come with you. Let's just say I take a step back and see how you fare on your own without that help. So he kind of looks at you to see if you have any questions or if you have any thoughts.
So you wish to come along.
Yes, I believe that this is a matter of critical importance, just given the nature, the high level of, give me an insight roll, actually, as he continues explaining just how important this is.
8.
Okay, so with an 8, he continues and he says, you know, this is, this professor, you know, as I've mentioned, it's more than just embezzlement. It's the nature of the embezzlement. He stole critical magical items, components, machinery that is used to make something that could be of danger to the world as we know it, if not entire nations. I believe that this is something that any soldier, any person who considers themselves a protector should follow up on with due diligence. And since you seem to be unfamiliar with the world, whether that's amnesia because of your time in the coffin or whether it's something else, I do believe I would be a help to you. And I do believe I would be a help to not just you, but also to the well-being of people at large if I were to accompany you and see what we might uncover about the professor's whereabouts.
You see, it's an interesting proposal you make, but I don't see why I would want to do that. To be honest with you, the last people that I adventured with left me to die. The people before that, they dumped a tankard of beer over my head and told me I was an asshole and left without me. You don't need to know the whole story. I don't think that you will enjoy traveling with me very much.
Okay, well, how about instead of traveling with you, what if I traveled behind you? Maybe I could follow closely, and it's up to me to keep up with you, it's up to me to follow you, but we're not traveling together, because I still think that there is a possible lead here that, again, I would be remiss to just watch wander off into the sunset if I were to give you the rights on those papers.
Do you have a record of these crimes by any chance? Any like proof that they happened?
The crimes of the marvelous Professor Frankenfooter?
Yes, you're looking for him. Yes?
As you say that second line, he just reaches into one of his like side pouches and pulls out a tightly folded piece of parchment, and it opens into a wanted poster where you see the visage of a very snidely whiplash-looking dude, to put it mildly. Got the curled mustache, he's wearing a top hat, he's got this sort of arrogant, smug grin on his face, and it says, "Wanted, dead or alive, the marvelous Professor Frankenfurter. Reward, 10,000 gold, if remanded to the Order Infernus."
Oh, that's quite a lot of gold.
And at this, Captain Ludlow looks a little bit abashed and kind of murmurs somewhat sheepishly, "Yes, it is a lot of gold. It might also be a promotion or two up the ladder."
"Well, in that case, I will discuss with the father. If I decide to travel with you, then I think I will take 80% and you will have 20% in your promotion."
Give me a persuasion roll on that. Take advantage, actually.
Advantage? Wow. That'll help the minus two. 12.
Okay, so just being transparent, like, you can tell based on the way he kind of talked about the money, but then the promotion, is that the promotion is by far the most important thing to him. So the fact that you're willing to give him like a share of the money, that's great, but the main thing he cares about is the opportunity for a promotion. You can tell that there's a little bit more going on with regards to the promotion and, you know, the ranks and everything like that, that he hasn't revealed to you, but he's very excited, and he almost like skips. Like, there's a little bit more of a bounce in his step that he did not have when he entered the chapel, as he strides boldly towards the back door and just kind of gives it a double knock with his knuckles to signal to Father Tully and the sister that they can come out. And the sister just kind of regards him very coolly and then looks at you and says, "So what's the arrangement that you came to with him, or at least have on the table?"
"Well, I did say that I wish to discuss with you and the good father first, but I believe that the constable will be accompanying me to find this person and claim the reward money." "Well, I will be claiming most of the reward money, but he will get some of it as well."
"Oh, you think that this little curio is going to be, what, redemption for you?" Captain Ludlow coughs a little bit anxiously, glances sort of surreptitiously at you very briefly, and just says, "I don't think I need to be redeemed for anything, but I do, if it got me back in," and he just kind of keeps stammering about it. She kind of sighs and crosses her arms and turns to you and says, "He's not putting everything on you, but Captain Ludlow is probably the only person in the entirety of the Order of Infernus that you can actually trust." She kind of shrugs and says, "Take that for what it is." And she looks at Father Tully, and Father Tully says,
"Well, yeah. So, Ludlow, are you saying that you would like me to complete the patents for him, or?"
And Ludlow looks at you and says, "If you're agreeing, Stephen, then yes, I would like Father Tully to complete the papers from you, and we can depart the island forthwith."
"Agreed." And Stephen will spit in his hand and proffer it to the constable.
The constable looks at your hand and spits in it too.
"In my hand. In my hand."
"Yes." And then he slaps his hand over it. Sorry, I couldn't resist.
Stephen looks a little confused, but shakes his hand and kind of shakes his hand off and wipes it on his pants and sits down to let the father and the constable sort things out, and begins stringing his longbow to ensure it hasn't been damaged by its time underground, however long that was, and also checking his scimitar and his short sword for any rust or damage that was not already present.
Father Tully goes into the back room, comes back out with a small ink bottle and a quill. He does ask you if you can present your finger. He just says,
"In order for this to properly work and to pass checks that the order will be giving these papers, I do need just a spot of your blood. Nothing too major, just a little prick, if you wouldn't mind. Do you extend your finger?"
"Yes."
All right, so he does that. It's painless. It's like checking, you know, your sugar levels. He pricks. There's the smallest bit of red that he then dips into the ink and then proceeds to write your name. And there's a glow, and you can feel just the wisp of arcane energy as your name is pressed into this paper. He folds it up, hands it back to you, sort of casually represses the seal for you, but he hands you back your papers. Captain Ludlow is looking at the jar under your arm and says, "What's that you have there?"
"I was actually about to ask about this. What do you think this is? I don't know."
So he kind of gives a look, asking permission, which I'm sure you give him in a nod, but he holds up the jar and kind of examines it. He's like, looks like it's swirling, kind of relaxing. Like, and now that he's holding it up to the light as the sun comes up more and begins coming through the stained glass windows of the chapel, you do see, in fact, that it's kind of like, it is a very thick fluid. It's almost tar-like, but there is like an almost purple sheen to it. And it does seem as if it's kind of moving as if, you know, when you stir a drink and there's still that like ongoing momentum as it swirls, it does seem like it's just perpetually spinning. And he puts his hand on top of the jar lens and kind of gives you a look with a raised eyebrow, like, can I open this?
Steven will kind of narrow his eyes and say, sure.
He opens the jar, and what comes out is, so this is a question for you. What smell or aroma do you think Steven finds most sort of relaxing or comforting?
Well, he is a ranger, so I would hazard a guess toward some kind of earthy scent, maybe even something like peat moss, you know?
And do you remark on any of this as far as the aroma goes?
Yes. Steven will kind of sniff at it and say, oh, smells like peat moss. I expected something a little less pleasant.
Meanwhile, Captain Ludlow has his eyes closed in this sort of like reverent appreciation of the aroma as he's breathing in slowly but deeply over the jar that's currently open on the, I'm kind of picturing it like on the pew between you, like he still has his hands on either side of the jar, but he's holding it between the two of you. And he says, really, I'm getting more of a just very rich whiskey and firewood. And he says, interesting, but no, I thought it was tar at first, but he kind of tilts the jar a little bit, but he says it doesn't move like tar. It's a little bit too, and it does seem a little bit too viscous, but it also doesn't have, to use a wine term, it doesn't have any legs. Like when he shifts the jar, none of it, there's no residue as he tilts it back. Like it doesn't have to run back down into itself. It's just a completely.
I would like to touch the liquid in the jar or the substance of the jar.
Oh, finally, I've been waiting for this. Okay. So just like Neo in the Matrix, when he touches the mirror, the black liquid wraps itself around your fingers and then begins to climb up and out of the jar until it wraps around your hand, up your forearm, and then it surrounds your entire body. If you check your inventory, you have living armor that you can now equip and attune to.
Okay, I will do so.
Yep, there's the explanation for my little bit of character sheet pickpocketery. So as the armor settles around you, you realize that, let's just say hypothetically, that at first it's being worn like a full long sleeve chainmail shirt. But then you think to yourself, oh, that's crowding my wrist too much. It's going to be a pain for, you know, using my longbow with this thing. And it instantly responds to your thought and recedes up to your biceps that it's more of a t-shirt sort of style now. So you realize that this thing is responding to your thoughts. And just as you think that, just as you think, wow, this is responding to my thoughts, you hear a voice in your head saying, boy, howdy, can I? Hi, I'm Abby.
Hello, Abby. You seem to be scale mail.
And Captain Ludlow was at first marveling at the fact that this substance ran up your hand. But now he's hearing you talking and he says, wait, are you talking to it?
Yes, it says its name is Abby. Do you have a gender?
No, I think I guess I'd be what you call non-binary. You know, I don't really conform to what people's genders, people's people.
Right. Yeah, so I'm just Abby. They, them, or it.
Let's go with it.
It. Yes. It says its name is Abby.
He kind of looks and says, well, Abby is quite the marvel. Abby, and he kind of looks at you for like permission to address Abby.
Steven will shrug, like, I don't know.
Abby, are you able to speak to me, or are you only able to speak with Steven because of your connection?
Steven, I don't know, do you want me to talk to this guy? You and I are kind of the mated pair, so it's up to you, buddy.
Sure, I don't see why not.
All right, so Abby, the sound just, because Abby doesn't have a mouth, Abby is just this entire substance, the sound just seems to come from the entirety of the sort of chainmail, and it just sort of radiates out doesn't have articulation. It's just sound pure and created synthetically. And Abby addresses Captain Ludlow.
Yeah, I can talk to you. Getting caught up here. It seems like we're all going to be working together.
And Father Tully begins hearing the voice as he's finishing up the papers and walking them over to you. And he kind of looks around, like in confusion, where he's trying to look and see if there's somebody at the door or somebody behind him or somebody else is coming to the chapel. But he just kind of looks at you, thinking that maybe some kid is outside the window. He says, if you need any other guidance before you leave the island, feel free to come in. You'll be heading east. The next boat is an express barge that will be headed to the city of Panda. So you have until sunset before you need depart. I'm sure Captain Ludlow will want to help you prepare in any kind of way that you might. And Captain Ludlow says, yes, we have about, checks the sun and says, we have about 5 hours until the Panda Express heads out.
The Panda Express?
He says, yeah. It's a boat that connects from the western city on the western shore of Bai and then passes through here, stops, drops off supplies, and then makes an express route without any other stops along the coast straight to the city of Panda.
I see. Do you happen to know anyone who would like to purchase a lightly used set of studded leather armor?
And he says, oh, yeah, we can absolutely sell that in town. So he stands up, kind of dusts himself off. He says, I'll need to pack too. So yeah, let's get going. Great. And he just, like, suddenly he has this vim and this sort of light in his face where he looks almost like a different person than who entered the chapel. And he's kind of murmuring to himself, like, can't wait to tell that unit that I'm heading out. Bunch of backstabbing. And just kind of murmuring to himself about some kind of people that he's excited to be rid of. But he leads you out of the chapel and he begins marching down towards the village. And he says, okay, with your papers all set, we'll be able to get on one of the ferry boats and get out to the Panda Express. Let's see. So he leads you into this fairly sizable village on the lowest mesa. You can see it's not a huge city by any means, but it's filled with more of these people that have animal heads. You can make out that there are shops for general supplies. There is a smith and armorer. There are general stores. There are even some, you know, grocers and things like that. You can make out that there is enough agriculture that this city is self-sustaining at the very least. So you can make out as you get closer to the piers that there are trade people that are, you know, some of these animal head people are delivering carts full of produce and other goods and things like that to be sold and shipped out. First, Captain Ludlow is going to take you to a general store. He's going to sell your studded leather armor. Give me a persuasion roll to see how well you do at selling the armor.
Sure. My 7 in charisma is really coming in handy so far, let me tell you. I got a 6 on my persuasion check.
Okay, so with a 6, the armorer kind of looks at you and just says,
well, you know, the thing about it is you lose about 2/3 of the value the moment you take it out of the armor shop. So, you know, something like this brand new, you get, say, 200 gold, but used and worn in and taken out and all that's clearly seen some action. Best I can do is 40 gold.
So I'm going to have Ludlow jump in and just give a persuasion roll on top of that. Unfortunately, Ludlow also just kind of says, all the best he can do is, come on, man. And the armor says, fine, give you 42. And so he just takes the armor without any further discussion. Walks it back before any further negotiation can take place. And then he counts out 42 gold for you and Ludlow. And Ludlow stands back as the gold is counted out, making clear that it's all yours. He looks towards the barracks and says, okay, I need to get myself packed and ready. You're welcome to keep me company while I do, or if you want to look around, we have 4 hours until departure for the Panda Express. You know, you're welcome to kind of meet me back here at the barracks if you need to.
I believe I will try to get to know Abby.
And Abby says, oh, shucks. Yeah, I guess we might be together for a little while. I mean, I don't really think I can...
Abby kind of shuts up about whatever he was about to say.
Abby, where are you from?
Well, there's the jar. And I remember being pulled. I used to be in a big black space as before the tiny black space. And that big black space was filled with stars.
So, in the sky?
Yeah, maybe. Sky's kind of blue, though. This The sky was black, but it was peaceful, and the stars were beautiful. I loved them so much. Did you know that each star has a story?
I knew that constellations had stories, but I did not know that individual stars had stories. Would you like to tell me one?
Oh, yeah. Each individual star has a story. I can't remember any of them now, though. But they are delightful. Maybe being pulled kind of wiped my slate in terms of the stories I remember. But maybe I'll remember them someday.
Is there a way that I can help you remember?
And Abby, you feel this kind of like warm settling of Abby as Abby begins to feel simultaneously like armor, but also like a very cozy sweater.
Right now, I'm kind of fascinated in this story. So let's, maybe this story that we're setting out on will get us going.
At this, I would say this is the point where Captain Ludlow kind of stops at the door to the barracks. All right, I'm gonna tell my unit that I'm reassigning myself to escort, and that I've received an official order, edict, to escort you, and then we'll be free to go. Captain Ludlow walks into the barracks, and there, you know, six men sort of sitting around. All of them have animal heads, but they are wearing Order of Infernus armor similar to Captain Ludlow's, but just a little bit less ornate. Four of them are playing cards at a table. The other two are just kind of like, one's reading and the other one's just taking a nap on a cot nearby. But Captain Ludlow clears his throat. Gentlemen, I'm here to update you on current orders and status of this operation. I have received orders from HQ that I am to escort this VIP east to Panda. Blotto, you are being promoted to captain in my absence. You are acting captain. The others you will be reporting to and responding to him as if he were your captain, starting at, and he looks and he says, at noon. I will be packing to leave. If there's anything that you need from me in terms of a knowledge transfer or any approvals before I depart, please let me know. But I will be in my quarters preparing to leave. On a more personal note, I suppose if any of you would like to see me off with a drink, I will be headed to Blank's Tavern before departing for a usual toast. Thank you. The men kind of look from Captain Ludlow to you. Blotto, you can tell which one Blotto is because he kind of puffs up and does like a little shimmy very proudly and smugly, while the others kind of look on in consternation at him. Meanwhile, Captain Ludlow walks to a door at the back of the barracks and enters it. And inside of it, you can see personal quarters that aren't very big. It's just basically like a dorm room. It has, you know, bed, a desk, and a single ward, small wardrobe. But Captain Ludlow leaves the door open as he begins packing a bedroll and backpack to essentially equip himself to match you. But you're standing there with the men, and you can do whatever you want. The men are kind of looking at you quizzically, but none of them are speaking up.
Stephen, being the very socially adept person he is, will nod once and go sit down in the corner.
So Blotto is busy, begins talking in a low voice to a couple of the people that he's playing cards with. So the four of them at the card table are kind of stooped over. The one who was reading, she kind of snaps her book shut, like gives kind of a furtive glance at the people playing cards and then kind of walks over to you. You can give me a perception roll if you'd like to try to overhear what's happening at the card table.
I would love to try to overhear what's happening at the card table. I got a 14.
Okay, so with a 14, you're hearing some susurru as they speak in low-hissed voices, just saying, do you think I'll still get the promotion if he... And the others are like, we already did it. How are we going to get it out of the whiskey? I don't know, but maybe we get him to toast with something else tonight then, and we just dump it or something. So you hear them kind of whispering in that way. The woman comes up to you and,
you know, I was working the mail carrier today. I didn't see any orders come in from HQ. Who are you?
I'm Stephen Hark, and he'll kind of look around the woman to the men playing cards. And Stephen will kind of stalk up to them and rest one hand on the scimitar at his waist and kind of put the other on his hip and say, were you poisoning your captain?
Give me an intimidation roll.
Well, surprisingly, I am actually proficient in that. Two!
Blotto sits back, just kind of very casually, just kind of does that thing where he like flicks his teeth with his tongue and just pulls at a card and tosses it into the center to take his turn at whatever game they're playing. No, we're just talking about a surprise
for Captain, you know, making sure we're sending him off proper.
Abby, I have a strange question.
Yeah, what's up?
Did you hear what they said?
Let me roll for Abby. Abby absolutely did. And at this point, do you want Abby to be speaking out loud or do you want Abby to be... Because I think Abby can sense when you want Abby's voice broadcast versus keeping it tightly internal. So which would you prefer right now?
I will ask it to speak out loud for the moment.
So just as I described, this sort of synthetic voice emanates from all around your torso. And it says...
Oh, yeah, they were talking about the fact that they already slipped the poison into the captain's whiskey that he always orders because he's the only one that orders it. And they were talking about the fact that, they're not sure if it'll look right that one of them got promoted to captain right at the same time that the captain happened to die from poisoning.
I see. Is there any chance that you could play back their voices exactly? Or is that not something that's within your capabilities?
He says, you know, I think I could probably do a decent impression. Let me see how well we roll for performance on Abby's part. Okay. So Abby literally is able to apparently serve as like a RoboCop constantly recording evidence. entity now. So you have like evidence tape constantly running on your person where Abby just perfectly recreates the conversation and is actually able to magnify it. So it's as if you're sitting there amongst all four of them. And Ludlow kind of hears this elevated volume, says, wait, what's that? Abby just repeats the recording a second time, them talking about poisoning him. And he comes in and Ludlow just kind of looks at you, looks at them, just kind of sighs and says, I should kill you all or something, but then I would be stuck here until they send replacements and I would have to fill out so much paperwork. I'm out of your hair. I'm gone. How about you guys just go and tell Blank that whatever you did to his whiskey and it's out of your pockets, you're going to have to replace the whiskey, but that's on you. And anybody who happens to order the whiskey and dies until you do this, that's on you too. So that's it. No drinks, no send off, no nothing. I tried.
Steven will raise his hand looking at Ludlow.
And Ludlow kind of looks at you just very forlornly and kind of nods for you to speak.
Do you want me to kill them?
Ludlow shakes his head and says, no, if only because it means I'll be stuck here for potentially up to a week until it all gets sorted out with HQ. Let's just let them go. I mean, I know I tried my best with them and everything else after that is on them. So I can't.
You're going to leave policemen who wanted to poison their superior officer, I assume to kill him, to police this island?
One of the other men at the table, kind of scratching their head a little bit nervously.
Oh, you know, fair being fair, he's kind of a shit policeman.
And he kind of looks at Ludlow and just kind of shrugs like, we all know it, right? And the men at the card table kind of nod. And then the woman who introduced herself as Turbo also says,
he just doesn't understand the priorities of the order. And, well, our stars are hitched to his wagon now as our captain. And a captain that's so lowly regarded means that we, by association, are poorly regarded. But I didn't vote for this particular plot. But Captain Ludlow is not exactly the shining star of the Order Infernus.
I'm glad that's all sorted out, and I'm glad we can all be friends after such a misstep. Very well, I will see myself out. This seems like a private police family matter. And Stephen will duck out of the barracks and just stand against the wall waiting for Ludlow to come out.
Meanwhile, as you're waiting outside, Ludlow goes back into his quarters to finish packing. And as he does so this time, he shuts the door behind him, not being willing to leave it open. Abby, meanwhile, as you kind of settle outside, where you stand, like where do you picture yourself standing? So like this barracks is pretty much on the precipice of this sheer cliff that drops about 200 feet into raging ocean waters. And the pier that I mentioned is really just this sort of extension, this constructed extension off the island where pulleys and things like that are lifting ships and hoisting them 200 feet into the air so that they are essentially docked on level with the plateau. You know, you can see one of the ships being hoisted up. It's this large skiff, and there's a call that shouts, "Ferry to the Panda Express has arrived. People may begin loading cargo. We'll be departing in 3 hours." Mm. So there's a certain amount of lineup with people with cargo that are already lined up to begin loading onto the skiff. You're kind of standing maybe about 100 feet away from that sort of dock, for lack of a better term. And Abby sort of remarks to you,
"Oh, hey, those are the two guys that were watching us when Pringle took us out of the coffin."
Oh?
And so Abby is able to kind of like telepathically guide your gaze to a sort of like alley between two buildings across the sort of boulevard space that you're currently standing on by the barracks. And you do indeed see two young looking people. One of them happens to have a dog face and the other one has a pigeon for a face. And they are kind of like hiding behind a pair of barrels and seem like they're trying to hide. And once your gaze turns toward them, they duck behind the barrels.
"Hey, you two tried to kill me." And Steven will begin stalking toward them, kind of unlimbering his longbow and drawing an arrow.
Okay. The one with the pigeon head just immediately like sees the arrow and turns and starts to run down the alley. The one with the dog head, on the other hand, puts his hands up and just starts saying,
No, we weren't doing that.
And is just kind of stammering out excuses.
I will not shoot them. I'll let the pigeon head go and walk up to the dog head. I'll put my arrow away and sling my bow back over my shoulder and say, "Talk fast.
Listen, we just were looking for some money. We thought that, you know, this person, we heard that they'd been buried with all kinds of belongings and all that, and we thought that we'd been ready. The only other way we have to make money is in the damn theater troupe, and we can't do it. We were just trying to get out of here."
And so all of a sudden he gets down on his knees and puts his hands together, and the saddest puppy dog eyes are looking up at you. And he just begins pleading,
"I'm so sorry. We thought we were robbing a dead man. And what use does a dead man have for riches that he's buried with? We understand taboo and all that, but please understand, sir. Look at this island. Look at how isolated it is. You must understand what injustice it is for a dead man to be buried with more riches than I might ever hold in my entire life otherwise."
I think I should make a charisma save to resist the puppy dog eyes.
Absolutely, you can. I'll even make a charisma roll to see what you're trying to beat.
Well, I got a 3.
Okay, so with a 3, this puppy dog has all the angles. They do like the little like furrowed brow thing with like the big eyes, and then the puppy dog face does the killer move is when it does that little like head cock, like 45 degrees to the left that dogs do. And it just, that kills me every time. As he's like whimpering, he starts doing the and he says,
"We were only watching you because we saw Pringle take you out of the grave, and we were just confused as to how a living man was buried here. It was just curiosity, I swear."
"Oh, fine. Do you want a job?"
There's a moment of shock and a little bit of fear in his eyes, but he slowly nods.
"Great. You are now my apprentice, and I will very casually and kind of irritatedly tap him on each shoulder with my hand, and my squire and whatever other titles you see fit to claim, you will, I don't know, fetch me my dinner here. Your first week's wages, and I will toss him 1 gold coin.
Give me a perception roll. Or actually, sorry,
17.
Also give me a persuasion roll as well.
Separately from the perception?
Yeah. With advantage on the persuasion.
Okay. I only rolled it once, so I'm going to roll it again. Oh, well, it's a good thing I had advantage because I got a -1. 10.
Okay. So with a 10, as he catches the gold out of the air, you can see tears coming down his face. And with one hand, he catches the gold. And with the other, his eyes go wide with desperation and fear. And he says,
"No, Mox, no, he's good.
And just as he starts saying that, you look behind you and you see that the pigeon-headed person had run down the alley, doubled back and snuck around you and cut your coin purse and your papers off and is now sprinting away up the mesa.
Is the pigeon head running at 70 feet around, four, like 60 feet around roughly?
So he's going to dash about 30 feet up the boulevard away from the dock, and then he's going to make a sharp turn into an alleyway to lose direct line of sight from you. Because basically the way I'm seeing it is you're currently facing the alley that you originally spotted them in, right? So he would have to run past you and basically give you an attack of opportunity if he were to run into that alley. So instead, he's going to run away. He's already gotten out of your reach and he's running away towards a different alley between buildings further up.
I will sprint after this creature. I believe, if I remember my tracking rules correctly, that I need to roll survival for it. And if I'm moving at a sprint, then I need to do that at disadvantage. Is that correct?
I think so. Come up with some chase rules on the fly.
Okay, that's fine too.
And things like that. So you're able to make the first turn after him pretty easily because he has enough of a head start on you that you're not losing him just yet. So he's not able to juke you, so to speak. The next thing I need is, because the alley is shorter, because you're both basically moving at the same speed, I need a perception roll to see if you're able to spot which way he turns. So like the alley, this building ends in a T intersection, and I need a perception roll to see if you spot whether he goes left or right.
I will bring up, I am like a little bit faster than him. My walking speed is 35 feet.
Okay.
You know, obviously I won't catch up to him in one round, but it would help. You said make a perception check?
Yeah. So just to explain what I'm kind of formulating as the rules for this in my head as we go. Right now he's 30 feet ahead of you. And each time you make a correct roll for like perceiving which way he goes to try to juke you, or, you know, make a correct roll of like jumping over something he might throw in your path to try to slow you down, you will gain 15 feet on him or lose 15 feet from him.
Gotcha. I got a non-natural 20.
Okay. So the non-natural 20. So you'll either catch him, and I'm going to say, just for balance, you'll either catch him by getting two of these and get it down to zero, obviously, or you'll lose him if he gets 60 feet away from you. So the first one is successful. You see that you see his legs disappearing to the left just as you come around the corner of the alley. And as you turn around, there's a back door to a restaurant and a tavern master that has a horse's head. He throws this horse-headed person that's carrying these like sacks filled with foul, smelly things. He throws him in your path with a spin to try to get you. So give me a dex save.
Do you want a dex save or do you want an acrobatics check?
Let's make it an acrobatics check, sure.
That is, again, a non-natural 20.
Wow. Okay. So it's just like a perfect ballet sequence where first he grabs this horse-faced guy and without losing any of his momentum, just kind of like spins and flings this guy towards you. And you do the same pirouette move where you catch this horse-faced man and just spin around him without losing a step. And as a result, you are able to catch up to him. And how are you catching? Are you just trying to like grab him by like the back of the shirt and yank, or are you trying to do a full-on tackle?
I will do a full-on tackle. I know that from the way you've described these people, I assume that they are children, teenagers, something like that. I know that urchins can be somewhat slippery. So I will be tackling instead of grabbing clothing, because clothing can be slipped out of.
Okay, so let's call that an unarmed strike, and I'm going to roll an acrobatic save against your unarmed strike.
Okay. Ooh, I got a 5. Or 12, sorry. 12.
Still not quite enough. He manages, as he's clutching your papers, you can sense the stink of fear on him as he reaches another intersection, and he ducks under you, and you just, your eyes meet from just 6 inches away as you fly over him. So he takes off down the alley, and as you're collecting yourself, so you're now another 15 feet behind him, you see your new squire actually get into the alley and says, "Mox, stop," and tries to spread his arms, and I'm going to roll contested for them. And the pigeon, you just hear the pigeon go, "Coo," as he slides under your squire, and the squire just looks baffled by how perfectly executed that slide was. So we're still in the chase. If you are going to continue pursuing, you are 15 feet behind him. So your squire is following just a few feet behind you now, trying to catch your friend. You're back out onto the main boulevard. So once again, he is going to try to use the crowds to his advantage, but he's going to roll with disadvantage because there's so much wide open boulevard that it's going to be harder for him to try to really create an obstacle for you that you can't just take a wide berth around. So go ahead and give me an acrobatic save.
15.
All right. So with a 15, he tries to sort of weave and fake you out around this large group of people that are kind of wandering slowly, carrying a bunch of food. But you just manage to hurdle jump over these wheelbarrows of food to his astonishment. And yet again, make another unarmed strike to see if you can tackle him down.
19.
And so with a 19, you leap over balefuls of melons and tomatoes and other produce, and you just tackle the pigeon-headed boy, and he just lets out this sort of cooing gasp as you pin him to the ground. And the crowds are just in shock and awe. You can see up the road that somebody is pointing to you with and speaking to an Order of Infernus patrolman, but you have the pigeon-headed boy pinned.
I will grab my coin purse off of him and more gently grab my papers as well and stand up.
The young boy just says, "He's going to be so mad with me. He's going to be so mad at me."
"Well, you're hired as well." And Stephen will do the same kind of irritated, exasperated knighting gesture with his hand, toss the boy another of his gold pieces. He will say, "Keep up," and begin walking toward the Panda Express.
As you begin walking, though, the Order of Infernus patrol person that was pointed at you approaches you and says, Hold. "Am I to understand that you visited the chapel of the Order of Honda Days earlier?"
"I did."
"I understand that you, based on word that has gotten around, that you may have other business." As he is speaking, he notices Captain Ludlow approaching. He says, however, before you depart, the head of our mining operations would like a word with you, if you would, please."
"I have less than 3 hours. Will this be quick?"
That certainly can be. "I'm Captain." And Captain Ludlow approaches and they exchange salutes. Captain Ludlow says, "What's this now?" "The Lady Blanchette has received word of a strange occurrence in the graveyard. Apparently Pringle came up to have lunch with the foreman. She just would like a moment to speak to you and this person who resurrected themselves."
"I suppose we can spare a moment."
And Captain Ludlow shrugs and says, "Yeah, it sounds better than awkwardly standing around going away drinks that I'm not going to have anymore. Can we get a couple of horses just to make it a little bit more efficient?" And the patrol person says, absolutely. And he hustles off and disappears into a building, comes back around from stables in the rear, leading two horses for you. Captain Ludlow takes the lead and looks at the two street urchins and kind of says, "I guess each of them can kind of ride front saddle with us." And so he hoists the pigeon-headed boy, Marks, up onto the front side of his saddle and leaves Groucho, the dog-headed boy, to jump up into your saddle with you.
So together they're Groucho,
yes,
Marks.
Yes, correct.
I see.
Panda Express, Groucho, Marks. What other portmanteaus am I going to throw at you?
There seems to be an order of worshiping a particular type of car that I like, so I appreciate that.
Yep. So you proceed up to the highest plateau, and there is but a single slope that allows access to this supposed mining operation. It only goes in through the graveyard, so you have to pass back through the graveyard, and as you do, you ride by the little shack, and you see Pringle kind of peering furtively out of a corner of his window, and as he notices you looking at him, just kind of shuts the curtain very quickly. Meanwhile, going up the slope towards the main gates, you see a watch person positioned at the top of the gate. They look down and say, and they shout back into the yard, "Captain Ludlow here! Captain Ludlow here!" The gates begin to part open for you to enter. Inside, you can just see a packed dirt yard filled with tools, filled with large mining equipment. You can see a storage shed where probably other supplies and utilities are. And then you can see a large mouth to a cave that digs into this black obsidian mountain at the back of the island. There is a large two-story building sort of at the far end of the yard from where you're entering. Ludlow walks the horses there and ties them up outside. From inside the building, before you can even dismount, another man with this time a bull's head comes out. Oh, sorry, a woman with a bull's head comes out and greets you and says,
"Ludlow, you weren't thinking of skittering off without checking in with Lady Blanchette, were you?"
Ludlow shakes his head and says, "I wouldn't if she were to be offended by it, so here I am. However, we are trying to catch the Panda Express, so time is short," and he kind of motions for you all to go inside. So the bull-headed woman introduces herself to you. She says,
"My name is Dee. I work for the Lady Blanchette. I'm the head foreman here."
Lady Blanchette is the manager of the mines on behalf of the Honda Dace Church. So she wanted to know a little bit about you, so hold your story for just a moment as she ushers you into a dining room filled with food. There's a banquet set out, lots of carafes of wine, even a glass of whiskey at a seat already for Captain Ludlow, and a woman with another, this time a white fox head, so a snow fox, stands up and she's wearing this elegant sort of garb.
So you're the curious person that came back to life in our graveyard that Pringle has no record of burying. How strange. Please, come in. I would like to hear your story before you leave our island.
And she gestures for you all to take seats. The two urchins are just flabbergasted at the spread, and they dive in and begin eating, helping themselves to fruits. They're grabbing bread and spreading jams on them. Ludlow, meanwhile, kind of lets out a little wistful sigh and sits down, takes a sip of the whiskey, and then kind of has that same sort of appreciative look on his face that he previously had. Lady Blanchette motions to the seat to her left for you to take. She's currently sitting at the head of the table. And Dee, the head foreman, is currently behind you.
I will sit.
Dee closes the door and kind of nods. And so you and your party are alone with the Lady Blanchette. And the Lady Blanchette looks a little bit, just a little bit affronted at the fact that Captain Ludlow has already taken a sip and says,
I believe proper manners dictate that we should toast coming back from the dead or somehow springing to life. Seems like it's worth a toast. And she asks, would you prefer whiskey or wine? And she addresses you.
Do I seem like a wine kind of person?
And she smiles a little bit, you know, a little bit of flirtation in that smile. But she grabs the decanter of whiskey, pours a glass for you, pours a glass for herself, holds it up and says,
to life everlasting, or at least returning. Welcome to the rock.
And she holds it out to you and for a cheers.
Stephen will look confused and clink glasses and down the entire thing in one go.
So she takes a sip, sets it down, and takes a deep breath and says,
I want you to understand that I believe that everything should serve a purpose, which is why I've called you here. There is vermin in our minds, and it is not the usual type of vermin. This vermin seems most concerned with taboo arts. We have gained evidence that mining operations are no longer safe for us, and we have discovered this affront at the same time that somebody has curiously resurrected themselves out of our graveyard. Whether the two instances are linked or not, I do believe it is in your interest to go and investigate for us, just as much as it is in my interest to protect my people, because we have a limited supply of workforce on this island. And since you are about to depart and will not serve as a worker for my mines, you should serve as an investigator at the very least.
I have, 2 hours until my ship departs? What do you expect me to do in that time?
I expect you to go down into the mines. There is someone or something, a greater than lurking intelligence, that has been stymieing our operations in the deepest and most valuable threads of our digging operation. Captain Ludlow, you are aware of the importance of our operations to both the Order Infernus as well as to the Order of Honda Days. I would ask that you go in, see what is lurking down there, dispatch of it, or bring it back to the light. And if you are running late for the Panda Express, I will have them delayed. Our operation is, of course, of crucial importance to both orders that govern this island in tandem. Captain Ludlow, would you agree that it would be most remiss if you were to leave me here with a report that we were not able to meet quota for deliveries for either the church or the Order Infernus?
And Ludlow, clearly not holding a very good poker face, does look a little bit anxious about that. He kind of leans in and whispers to you,
since you're new here, I can explain that this mining operation doesn't just produce gems or ores. They actually produce gunpowder. This is the only mining operation in the entire world that has the formula and direct access to all of the ingredients needed to produce black powder. As a result, if its supply were to run out, it would send alarm bells up, so we might want to see our way to helping them so we can leave the island peacefully.
Does Steven know what guns are, what gunpowder is?
I'll defer to you on that. I mean, it's a matter of what your world is, because I'm going to reveal something to you. You are absolutely not from this world. So it's a question of you and what you think the context is Steven's world.
I'm going to say no. So he's going to say, what is gunpowder?
Interesting. Gunpowder is an explosive powder that we are able to chemically create out of several ingredients that are naturally mined. And through a chemical process, we produce a highly volatile substance that, when packed together, can be used to create explosions of great magnitude. Let's say that if I were to put about 8 ounces worth of it into a stick, tightly wrapped, and ignite it with just the smallest spark of flame, it would produce an effect akin to what a wizard can cast at, say, medium levels with one of their fireballs. And she begins to regard you with a certain fascination. She looks at Captain Ludlow and says, I understand the speculation is that he might be an amnesiac, but I'm starting to think that he simply isn't from here.
Well, I certainly have never heard of any of these places or people that you're discussing, so I believe I'm from very far away.
And she says, so how do you feel about helping out the Lady Blanchette myself? It would be most appreciated, and I could make it worth your while.
Give me some of this gunpowder, and we have a deal.
Give me a persuasion roll on that.
One. Not, I didn't roll a one, I rolled a three, but it's a one.
She kind of gives you a half smirk and says, unfortunately, our quotas are very tightly monitored, because you see, the Order Infernus and the Church of Haunted Days are so concerned that neither one of them gets more than the other, that we have to provide a to-the-grain-of-powder accounting of how much of this powder we produce and how much we release. A certain amount of it would certainly go missing and raise questions that I do not think our Captain Ludlow would like following him off the island. Now, would you, Captain? And she gives a very meaningful look at Captain Ludlow, who once again looks very anxious at whatever she is implying. You can make an insight roll on this if you'd like.
I would like to, yes. Six.
So with a six, it's clear that you're not able to read into whatever is actually causing Captain Ludlow's anxiety, but he just looks like he definitely wants you to help this out, and that it would probably be a good idea to help her out or at least ask for something more reasonable.
Do you have any quality weapons?
And at this, she smiles more genuinely and more broadly and says, why, yes, we do. I do believe I can outfit you much, much more effectively for your departure as soon as you come back.
Good enough for me. Well, squires, stay here. If I die, then good luck.
And she stands and says, one other thing I will add to the terms of our deal for your reward is that I will provide you the antidote.
The antidote to?
To the poison that we all just consumed. I did not expect you to be necessarily so agreeable, having just resurrected from death, and being accompanied by a member of the Order of Infernus, I thought a little bit more pressure might be needed, but since we've come to terms with it, I'll just tell you that the antidote to the poison that will kill you in 24 hours will be a part of your payment for clearing the mine.
I see. Best to be about it, then.
My head foreman D will escort you into the mines and deposit you at the beginning of the thread that we believe is the most likely locus for the, shall we say, bane of the depths. Thank you.
You see Lady Blanchette reach into one of her sleeves and she pulls out a pretty sizable vial that's about 4 to 5 ounces of liquid. She unstoppers it, takes a quick sip of it, replaces the stopper, and slides it deep into her sleeve again.
So she has the antidote.
She has the antidote. And meanwhile, the two urchins with you are looking to each other with a very, like, what did we get ourselves into? But Groucho, the dog head young urchin, looks up at you.
You're gonna figure this out, right? Like you came back from the dead. I mean, you could probably handle whatever things in the mine. Like, you're the scary one here, right?
I'm sure I'll be fine.
All right, he's sure he'll be fine.
And the pigeon coos, and D ushers you to the mine and to the mouth of it, just puts fists on either side of her hips and just shrugs and says, well, it's all on you then, and just gestures for you to enter the mines. Captain Ludlow is very clearly right at your shoulder, ready to go in. As you venture into the depths of the mine, as Captain Ludlow accompanies you, you see these two urchins standing at the mouth just behind D, and there's a little bit of anxiety for them. Like, you can see it on their faces that they are very much considering whether to just hightail it and run.
But as anxious as Marks might look, Marks definitely looks like the more fearful of the two. I mean, he's got a pigeon head. But true to the nature of a loyal dog, I rolled to see if Groucho would stay there. And Groucho sits crisscross applesauce and just gives you a thumbs up and is going to wait for you as you venture into the mines.
Thank you for listening to D&D Versus. This episode features J.T. Embley as Stephen Hark and yours truly, Yanato Ballou, as your Dungeon Master. D&D Versus is not affiliated with Wizards of the Coast, and our next episode is coming out in 2 weeks on April 17th. Support us and this show at patreon.com/D&D Versus.